Morning Glory and Evening Grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, and I have a considerable task in front of me. I have to connect up the effort by Raul Labrador to become the new majority leader and defeat Kevin McCarthy of California, and Kevin's a friend, with ISIS's running all over northern Iraq and executing 1,700 Iraqi soldiers, with Iran's offer to help John Kerry's accepting of that offer, with Marlon Stutzman's whip race, Robert Costa, David Drucker, and Jack Kingston's Senate race, all into a narrative that somehow weaves in and out around the book, The Conscience of the Constitution. The Conscience of the Constitution is linked over at HughHewitt.com, and the reason I'm pushing The Conscience of the Constitution today is threefold. Number one, it's a very fine book about a very important subject. Number two, it will fix all of our problems if people will pay attention to it. And number three, it is the first book that I have ever talked about on air by a student of mine. Timothy Thandifer tormented me through a year of constitutional law from the back left row. I remember him well, hurling thunderbolts at me when I got anything wrong, which was often, or quarreling with any ordinary interpretation. He's a Hillsdale graduate, and he is a Chapman Law School graduate. He is now the senior legal counsel at the Pacific Legal Foundation and an adjunct fellow at Cato, an adjunct scholar at Cato. And the new book, The Conscience of the Constitution, is really quite wonderful, and it's linked at HughHewitt.com. Thandifer, welcome into the studio. It's great to have you on.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back in front of you.
Now, I have a lot of scores to settle with you from the year that you tormented me, so I intend to try and do that. But the number one is, why do you appear on other radio stations by know-nothings and then pretend that they know what they're talking about?
Well, I learned well the skill of pretending people know what they're talking about, and I hope to demonstrate it in effect today.
So, Conscience of the Constitution is about the Declaration of Independence and why it matters. And I wrote on the blog today that you are an originalist, and I am one of those who reconciled to the death of substantive due process, for which you've always thought me a squish, right?
That's true. I think substantive due process is an essential part of our Constitution, and although the phrase does not appear in the Constitution, the same is true of things like separation of powers, which we consider essential to our Constitution. I think substantive due process, which unfortunately has been denounced both by liberals and conservatives alike, is one of the most crucial bedrock principles of our Constitution.
And I've got to ask, are you at all hopeful that you are my favorite atheist? And if you believe that substantive due process is coming back, you're actually a Christian, because then you believe in the resurrection. Because it's dead, 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 Tim Thandifer.
Well, actually, if you're asking me if I feel optimistic, the answer is actually yes. I feel very optimistic about the future of constitutional law in this country, because I see a rising generation of young lawyers who will become the next generation of judges, law professors, and attorneys who are second-guessing, who they're questioning the assumptions of the past generation, which were generated during the New Deal, assumptions that did great damage to our Constitution. And I see young attorneys who come to clerk for us at the Pacific Legal Foundation, or who go into jobs in public interest law suing the government for a living like I do, who really, they look at something like Kelo versus New London, the infamous eminent domain case, and they say, this is wrong. This is just obviously wrong. If something, as Justice Thomas said in that case, something has gone seriously awry with our interpretation of the Constitution.
But we're out of time.
Well, I don't think that, as Frederick Douglass said, nothing is settled that is not right.
Well, that might be true, but we are out of time. And Frederick Douglass said that after 400 years of slavery had already been in place.
And if you had said in 1857, if you had said to somebody, 10 years from now, slavery will be gone, and the Constitution of the United States will be amended to say that the government may not discriminate against people on the basis of race, you would have laughed in their face. You would have said, that is ridiculous. Didn't you just read the Dred Scott opinion? Don't you see what direction this country is headed in? The Kansas-Nebraska Act has been abolished. Slavery is going to spread to California. And people would have said, you were right. Most people would probably have agreed with you.
I don't think that's true. I think that the reaction of Dred Scott was so overwhelming that the momentum was on the side of the abolitionists. So they might not have seen how quickly they would win. In fact, the abolitionists won with a speed that is reminiscent of those who have now claim victory on same-sex marriage. They won in a space of in a period of time which no one thought possible.
I have to disagree with that. I don't think the abolitionists ever won. The thesis of my book, that when I talk about the conscience of the Constitution, what I'm talking about is that the principle that the abolitionists believed in, that all people are by nature free and government has no right to take that freedom from them. And eventually they did win the day by their principles being incorporated into the new Republican Party. But the abolitionists themselves never won. The abolitionists in the 1850s were always a screaming radical majority who were laughed at by both parties, just like libertarians are today. And they won in the realm of ideas, but not the realm of politics. They won in the realm of arguing about principle. And that I see it as my job.
Actually, I couldn't disagree with you more. They won because Lincoln won, and Lincoln was in a position of power when the opportunity arose to abolish slavery,
he
and therefore
won elections. No. What Lincoln ran for president on was to keep slavery from spreading west, and that was the death knell for freedom in this country if he had lost that. See, what the abolitionists won was to stop slavery from spreading, but had they lost that, then slavery would have become nationwide permanently.
And what I come back to is though, Lincoln won the election, which put him in a position to capitalize on the opportunity that arose.
Yeah.
Right now, the forces of good and freedom are losing elections because we're bad at it compared to the forces
I agree with that.
Of rent seekers. Rent seekers, I mean, you have a chapter in here on how faction became renamed rent seeking, which I think was unfortunate, by the way. I think rent seeking is a concept that very few people get, special interest people get, and so we ought to dump that. But you have a chapter in here on how that happened. And in fact, the rent seekers are everywhere. I was just in Washington, D.C. Do you realize Washington, D.C. is awash in money? It is the new Rome.
It's the wealthiest community in the United States. It's the, as they say, it's recession-proof.
It is not only recession, they're building buildings everywhere. The condominiums cost a ridiculous amount of money. There is no middle class. There's only an upper middle class. The professionalization of political rent-seeking is so much further advanced than when you were in law school, and certainly when I was in law school. I don't know how you get the tendrils out. I mean, it's sort of like ivy in a brick wall.
I have to come back to my slavery analogy. Had you said in 1857 that one day slavery would be abolished in the United States, not only would people have laughed at you, but they would have pointed to the fact that every civilization in history had had slavery and had kept it up until that time. And that there was that the trend, the idea that America was going to reverse that trend would have been laughable. And people would have said, there's no way that you can, on the force of merely arguing that freedom is a good thing, that you can change people's mind. That's ridiculous because people, all they care about is lining their pockets. And I don't think that's true. I think America is the first nation that was founded on the idea that accident of history is not what determines human fate. That what matters to us is ideas and the idea of liberty. And it's true that that people can be blinded to those principles. Thomas Jefferson, in his last letter, said, "All eyes are open or are opening to the rights of man. The general spread of the light of science has laid open to every view the truth that the mass of man was not born with saddles upon their backs and a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God." Well, in the 20th century, those eyes closed dramatically, and we had the rise of horrible tyrannies like Hitler and Stalin. And again, lots of people thought those would be permanent, and they weren't.
And I look at Mosul today, and I say to myself, the saddle is on, the horse is unsaddled again. I'm talking with Timothy Sandifer. The book is The Conscience of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence and the Right to Liberty. It is a primer that you ought to avail yourself of. It's linked over at HughHewitt.com. It's at Amazon.com. It's a Cato book. It will make you familiar with the arguments all the way back to the beginning, but the terrible wrong tour taken in something called the Slaughterhouse Cases, which I think when you were in my class, I taught them as a matter of fact development, not
I remember ranting about that at the time.
Well, it's just I'm not one to tilt at windmills, but if you like windmill tilting,
what else can you tilt at?
You can tilt at winning elections. Like the one thing you haven't said, which I expected you to say, the demise of the filibuster opens the door to people like you getting confirmed as a judge. Now, you could never been confirmed as a judge until
now. You mean the abolition of the nuclear option for judicial appointments.
Right.
I was happy about that. Even though we lost in the short term, I think we're going to win it in the long term. Now, it's true. It turned around and bit me, actually, because I argued a case last month in front of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals against the constitutionality of Obamacare. And
on the originalism clause?
On the origination clause.
On the origination clause?
Right.
You argued that?
Yes.
Who was the panel?
I'm sorry. My mind is blanking. Two Obama appointees and a Clinton appointee.
Oh!
And because we were jokingly referring it to it as the death panel. And it was because of the nuclear option being abolished. So in the short term, it's bad for us. But yes, I agree. In the long term, I think that the Democrats will rue the day that they saw the end.
So do I. And the reason will be that we will no longer have to summon up 60 votes to get someone confirmed. We can send people like you. How old are you?
I am 38.
So we can send 38-year-old libertarians if we have 55 votes in the Senate, and they will be confirmed. And that will be a very interesting thing. And now Mitch McConnell might want to put it back because it substantially changed the rules of the world. Yeah. And we'll talk more about that. In studio with me, Tim Sandifer. Tim is, I want to read his bio correctly, an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and a principal attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, which is a not-for-profit legal foundation headquartered in Sacramento, dedicated to defending economic liberty and private property rights. Sandifer is the author of Cornerstone of Liberty, Property Rights in the 21st Century, and The Right to Earn a Living, Economic Freedom in the Law. It does not note here he is also a graduate of the Fowler School of Law at Chapman University School of Law, and that he was tutored in con law, or at least he pretended to be tutored in con law, by none other than your host, Hugh Hewitt. Sandifer writes on page 124, "Majorities, after all, have little need for constitutions." Now, I often underline the key phrase in a book, and I've got a few cornerstone phrases in here. That may be the most important insight. Majorities, after all, have little need for constitutions. Would you explain that? Because then people will understand what conscience of the Constitution is about.
Because the purpose of the Constitution is to protect us against democracy. A lot of people think that the purpose of the Constitution is to provide for or create democracy. And on the contrary, the Founding Fathers understood that the majority doesn't need anything to increase its power because it's already the majority. So it can set the rules however it wants to if it has no limits. Like in ancient Athens, there were no limits on what the majority could do. And look what they did to Socrates, right? So the point of a Constitution is to limit what the majority can do by subjecting it to checks and balances, to procedural rules that make it have to do this and that. And the other thing, that's why the Constitution in its very first line says that liberty is a blessing. And it does not say the same thing about democracy or about government. Instead, it goes on for several pages limiting what democracy can do to protect the individual against the majority. The majority doesn't need a constitution. It's already the majority. It has all the power already. It's the individual or small groups who are persecuted or looked down upon who need a constitution as a shield to protect them.
In fact, what we see unfolding in Iraq right now is because constitutionalism did not take root.
Yes, the principle of the rule of law. I was thinking about this on the way over here. The fundamental principle of the rule of law is that not everything the ruler says is the law. If you don't believe that, then you cannot have a rule of law society at all. You have by a tyranny. If you believe that there are some things the ruler says that are law and some things the ruler says that are not law, then you have the seed that can grow into a flourishing society that protects freedom, that has institutions that foster capital development and innovation and improvement in living standards.
And if you believe that the ruler can only say things that are law if he has been given that authority explicitly in a written constitution, then you have constitutionalism.
That's right.
But you actually go further back, and this is a pretty tony argument that you have 2 minutes to make. Some people say the Declaration 1776 has nothing to do with the Constitution ratified 1789, including, among others, Robert Bork, Justice Scalia, a few other very famous conservatives.
Right.
You want to quarrel with them. You are of the Arnn School and of the other natural rights people out there that the Declaration matters quite a lot. You got a minute and a half to persuade people why that ought to be.
The Declaration of Independence is the fundamental law of this country. First of all, it appears in our statute books in Volume 1, Page 1 of the Statutes of the United States and in Volume 1, Page 1 of the United States Code. It purports to do legal things. It defines the United States as a nation as opposed to Great Britain. It's referred to in the Constitution of the United States when it says done in the year of our Lord 1787 and in the year and in the independence of the United States, the 11th. It's pointing at the Declaration. But most importantly, it says in the very first words, "We the people of the United States." Who is this people of the United States? It is the same people who have dissolved their political bands that have connected them with another people and have assumed among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, and it, as referred to in the Declaration. Thomas Jefferson referred to the Declaration as the fundamental act of union of these states. The states declared themselves independent connectedly as a people of the United States, and they did so in the Declaration. And so it lays the framework, the foundation stone on which the Constitution operates. Or the analogy I use, the Constitution is an engine that runs on the fuel that is the principles articulated in the
Other analogy you use is it's the conscience, the Jiminy Cricket, if you will,
right,
of the Constitution, meaning that it ought to be humming the music in the background by which the Constitution is understood, or at least made beautiful to people.
And those who don't understand that the Constitution is the guiding voice that tells us how to interpret the Constitution, those people who don't understand the Declaration plays that role, they're a fool. Yes, sirree.
That would include Stephen Breyer, who sat in that chair 2 years ago and said, "You're wrong, wrong, wrong." The book I'm talking about is The Conscience of the Constitution. It is authored by Tim Sandifer, in studio with me. On a day of great and terrible news from across the world, which I will dip into in hours two and three, Tim Sandifer's book is linked at HughHewitt.com. You can follow him at Timothy Sandifer, and I've tweeted out both the link to his book and posted it as well. In the conclusion, you write this: "In calling the Declaration of Independence the conscience of the Constitution, I have used the word advisedly, whether we imagine it as a still, small voice or Jiminy Cricket from Disney's Pinocchio. Conscience is a quality within us that seems to stand outside our more mundane thoughts to guide our actions. It lies at the boundary between is and ought. It understands reasons, and it gives reasons. It is the hallmark of a responsible person or nation. When it comes to the American constitutional order, the Declaration of Independence gives us the standard. It stands above our political arguments to explain the basis and limits of rightful government. Readers of the Constitution should choose their route thereby." And then you conclude by writing, "The time has come for the legal community to pay heed. The time has come to reject the notion that people have the right to control each other's lives and to take the fruits of their labor. The time has come to secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity." Very, very nice. Can't be done.
Of course it can be done. The reverse was done, so this can be done. And although it is always harder to build than to destroy, there's no reason in the world except our choice that we can't do it right now.
The 47% comment that Mitt Romney made that infamously doomed him was an inelegant attempt to say that the rent-seeking establishment has grown so large that the interest gridlock is too great to pierce. We're about to elect a Republican majority leader who is Kevin McCarthy from California, perfectly nice guy. He's K Street Kevin. He mediates K Street's needs to the Republican majority. They're the Freedom Party. How in the world can you be an optimist when K Street Kevin's about to romp to a victory?
Oh, I'm not an optimist in the short run. I'm an optimist in the long run. I think that the rising generation of law students has seen what a mess the previous generations have made of it, and I think that they're going to do a lot of good things. I think they're going to do a lot of bad things on the way, but I am very optimistic when I meet these students. And I, you know, majorities don't make history. It's well-motivated and devoted minorities who have always made history.
There is no one left in the academy to teach this. You went to the one law school.
No, no.
Eight of us.
Randy Barnett teaches at Georgetown Law Center.
Right,
you can't get farther left than that.
I know. I can name them all.
That may be true,
them.
But you could have named them all in a shorter period of time 10 years ago. It would have been zero, right?
I don't believe that's the case.
When I was in high school, I graduated from high school. Here, this will please you. I graduated from high school in 1994.
You're right. I hate that.
And at that time, I remember how even the word libertarian, most people had never heard. Nowadays, I remember when Clint Eastwood spoke at the Republican convention, he used the word libertarian in a positive way. I think that's the first time that's ever been done by a keynote speaker at a Republican convention. I can't
remember anything because I was so nervous that he wasn't going to finish his speech anytime that night. So
that's
I don't
right.
remember. And Stuart Stevens threw up when that speech was over, by the way. So.
I think that there are a lot of reasons to see development in the long run as being positive. I agree with you that we have messed things up badly. Although, again, if you take five steps back and look at the United States today in a historical sense, we are happier and freer and better off than humanity has ever been in world history. And we ought to count our blessings and then say, how can we do better?
Now there is a concurrence by Justice Roberts in Citizens United that says, here's when you can revisit a case and not do injury to stare decisis, the principle overriding fealty to past decisions, when it's wrong. Are you actually believing, because I think you do believe, that the slaughterhouse cases will one day be overruled as wrong?
I can't say whether it will be. I can say that there's no better reason for overruling a Supreme Court decision than the fact that it is wrong, that everybody
recognizes wrong.
Everybody knows that it is wrong, and that which is not right cannot stand. As Martin Luther King liked to say, the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Would you explain to people what the slaughterhouse cases did and why it has had such an adverse impact on our liberty?
That was the first case in which the Supreme Court ever interpreted the 14th Amendment, which at the time was new. And it was the amendment that said that constitutional freedoms had to be respected by states, which previously had not been the case. It was the climax of what had
Except
caused
it didn't
the Civil
say
War.
That. If it had said
yes,
that, it had been fine.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. It said no state shall make or enforce any law that shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And what are these privileges or immunities? They are the natural rights and the common law rights enjoyed by all Americans and articulated in the Declaration, among other places. And what the Supreme Court, in only a 5-4 decision, said was, no, we don't think we'll give any strength to that. The 14th Amendment only protects those rights that are, you know, a very narrowly limited set of rights that are already protected by other clauses of the Constitution. And since then, the Supreme Court has never enforced the 14th Amendment's privileges or immunities clause, with one or two minor exceptions.
Yes, a couple of bizarre cases.
And they were asked in the McDonald case only a few years ago to overrule the slaughterhouse cases. And what they said was, we don't think we need to address it. And Justice Thomas wrote this beautiful long opinion explaining why it was wrong. That's always how it happens. A precedent stands on the books until it's questioned, and when it's questioned, it's reinforced at first, except one justice says, I don't think that's right. Then the next time, two justices say, I don't think that's right. The next time, three justices say, I don't think that's right. Meanwhile, the debate goes on in the law schools, where students read these dissents, and they say, you know what? Justice Thomas was right in that McDonald case. We ought to overrule the slaughterhouse cases. And those law students are later appointed and become Supreme Court justices.
The debate goes on in the law schools. Do you really believe that?
Absolutely, I do.
No, it doesn't.
I've been to law school more recently than you have, Hugh.
No, it's not. I was there three weeks ago.
That's true.
I have to listen every year and try and get them to be interested in this, and they're not interested
in this. I'm not an optimistic person by nature. I am a pessimistic person, but this is one subject on which I honestly believe that we are making great progress. The idea of overturning the slaughterhouse cases, or the idea that Lochner was right, those were ideas that would have never even gotten a hearing 30 years ago in a law school. And
now
we have major conferences
skeptic?
And books
if
on these
infused,
issues.
If you infused substantive due process with real vitality, most of Washington, D.C. would fall apart. The facade of power, I mean, it would
that
shake
is right.
it to the foundation. The EPA would be out of business. The
inertia.
FDA would be out of business. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined by Tim Sandifer. Coming up next hour, David Drucker is going to fill us in on the latest in the majority leader, be a Raul Labrador guy. And we're going to try and figure out what's going on. Marlon Stutzman is the congressman from Indiana who is the real conservative running for whip. Steve Scalise is the neoconservative running for whip. That means not neocon in the way that neocon means. And then the smart guy running for whip is Pete Roskam. So it's a really interesting race, but we'll talk more about Raul Labrador. Going to stick around with me next hour, as well as Tim Sandifer, the author of The Conscience of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the Right to Liberty. You know, the stoning of Saria M. Was a big deal on this show because the director was a friend of mine, and he came in and talked about it, and we did everything we could to get
Great
attention
movie.
To it.
Great movie.
You've got to explain to people how the stoning of Saria M. ends up in a book about the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Well, I try to show why a society that's governed by whatever the ruler says is law, why that's not really an orderly society. People think that order means that there's strong government. And I try to show that even where a tyrant can control the system that and make people do what he wants, that's not really order. Order and liberty are very interrelated, so that without liberty, you don't really have order. And without order, you don't really have liberty. John Locke famously said this. And John Milton, whom we read in your class, said, good men alone desire liberty. The rest desire not liberty, but license, which hath no greater scope than under tyrants. And in Saraya M, the story circles around how Saraya has no rights in this little Iranian town because the local mullah and mayor can do whatever they want, and they rule in their own self-interest. And rulers who rule in their own self-interest, that's not really a free or lawful society. They don't really have law because they're simply governed by whatever the ruler wants or desires. The other example that I use in the book is the classic Twilight Zone episode, It's a Good Life, starring Bill Mumy as the little 10-year-old boy who can wish people off into the cornfield. One of the most beautifully done dramatizations of life in Stalinist Russia ever produced. It's really an ingenious piece of political philosophy. And they aren't in a free or orderly society either, because you can't know from one minute to the next whether you will be punished for doing something, whether you are free to do or think something. And those kinds of societies, unfortunately, are very common in history.
Are you really a Rawlsian at heart?
No. No, definitely not. I'm an objectivist. I am a follower of the philosophy of Ayn Rand, and I don't believe Rawls's idea that fairness and justice are the same thing. In fact, fairness and justice are very rarely the same thing.
But constructing an order in which you would live blindly without knowing what your role in the order would be is a very appealing, I think.
It is.
Concept.
I think it's kind of a pointless exercise, since no society is ever like that, with the possible exception, and Richard Epstein gets into this in his latest book, The Possible Exception of the U.S. Constitution. That is probably the closest you can get to an actual veil of ignorance, political society being developed.
This book is very provocative. It makes an argument that Americans ought to take very seriously whether or not their courts can be redirected towards actually defending liberty in a way the branding of which is almost impossible. It would be like trying to sell Edsel. It would be like arguing that the Edsel of American law, which is substantive due process, could be refurbished and mass-produced once again, because the branding that substantive due process received in the course of its repudiation during the New Deal and the Progressive Era was so complete, so utterly pervasive, that I just can't imagine rebranding that. It'd be like getting new Coke back out and trying to sell it to people again, Tim Sandiford.
Yeah, I understand that. And I think 20 or 30 years ago, I think that would have been a conclusive argument. I think, though, that the reason why I'm optimistic about the rising generation is I think that that sort of brainwashing no longer holds. I think people are realizing that the old court was right about some things. I mentioned that a few years ago, if you had said that Lochner was rightly decided, people would have not even bothered to listen to you. And now major scholars have published books on this issue, and there's conferences at law schools on this issue, and the next step is going to be judges willing to say that, and then the next step from that will be appellate judges willing to say that, and the next step is Supreme Court judges willing to say that. The law always works slowly. There's a reason why they sell ties at the U.S. Supreme Court gift shop that have little turtles on them, because the law is always slow, but it's inexorable, and nothing can stay, which is not right.
Yeah, but nothing can change unless you win elections, and the Republicans are the party of liberty, and they're getting crushed. And right now there are 55 Democrats and 45 Republicans, and there is a Democrat president, and we have not won, a Republican has not won since 2004, an outright
majority. And that's because the Republican Party has not been the party of liberty.
I was going to come back and say, so the secondary lesson of the conscience of the Constitution is that, but you're not a Rand Paul guy in foreign policy, though, are you?
That's true.
So what you really want is a return to Ronald Reagan.
Well, Reagan's rhetoric, his actual performance was actually not what people think it was. Reagan tripled the size of the welfare state when he was president. No, my argument is that principles matter. And if it's a clash between principles and politics, I've always chosen principles. But that's why I don't do politics, Hugh. I went into law because I can't stand the kind of compromising your principle. Like Mencken famously said that to succeed in politics, you have to learn to rise above principle. And I don't have that gene in me, and that's why I went into the law instead. There are others who are better at taking these principles and making real progress in the political realm. Abraham Lincoln, like you said. And that's their job, and I applaud them for that. My job is an attorney. As an attorney, is to articulate the principles of the Constitution, and if people don't listen, then they don't listen.
Now, I want people to understand the argument you just made before the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit 2 weeks ago.
That's right. Or last month.
Tell people what you argued and how a little tiny glimmer of hope about Obamacare is out there, though it will not come from this circuit panel.
That's right. We are arguing the Pacific Legal Foundation brought suit challenging the constitutionality of Obamacare on the grounds that if it is a tax, as the Supreme Court said 2 years ago, then it's still unconstitutional because it didn't originate in the House of Representatives as the Constitution requires. It says that all bills for raising revenue must originate in the House, and Obamacare originated in the Senate.
And the idea, however, is that the House bill that became the vehicle for Obamacare was a revenue bill. It just had nothing to do with Obamacare. And you're arguing that that is a false flag. That's not genuinely what the origination clause meant.
That's part of our argument. In fact, we argue that the House bill was not a revenue bill in the first place. It altered certain technical things about taxes that is did not actually impose any kind of levy. But also that even if it was a tax, the Senate cannot go in, erase the entire contents of a House-passed bill, substitute complete new language, replace a six-page bill with a 2,000-page bill on a completely unrelated subject, and then call it macaroni.
So it's not my dog. It didn't bite you. Besides, you kicked it first. The third
Or an example that I use the example of Abraham Lincoln's axe. This is Abraham Lincoln's axe, only the blade was replaced in 1890 and the handle was replaced in 1920. That's what the Senate did with the House bill, and then they're saying it's still Abraham Lincoln's axe.
Well, but you have to try and get a modern group of judges who understand they would be overturning the signature achievement and the only achievement we now understand of this president on the idea that most Americans would not understand that it did not originate in the House. That would require a majority of the Supreme Court to explain the origination clause. Do you see that happening?
Well, it's never been done. It's never been done. There's no Supreme Court case that really gets into. There's like only three or four cases at all on this issue, and none of them really get into the nitty-gritty about what the clause means. But again, that was also true of the Second Amendment for most of American history. It was only a few years ago that the Supreme Court took even the first case to address what the Second Amendment means.
Did any of the judges, two of whom were Obama appointees, one of whom was a Clinton appointee, give you the time of day? Did they give you some intellectual seriousness?
Yes, actually, they did. They asked a lot of questions about the Founding Fathers, which kind of surprised me.
Such as?
Well, what did the Founding Fathers think the Senate could do when they wrote the Origination Clause? And we pointed out that, for example, James Madison didn't want there to be this origination requirement precisely because he said it would lead to lawsuits about what origination means. And he lost that fight. And so, therefore, the Constitution allows the Senate to amend bills that come from the House, but not to originate taxes.
So it must mean something. And that's what right. was the purpose of the Constitutional Convention in putting that restriction in?
Well, they were very worried that the Senate, the least democratic branch of the United States government, would use the taxing power to foist things on the people that, if given the choice, people would oppose. If that sounds familiar to you, that's because that's exactly what happened with Obamacare, which was rammed through Congress in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve without any serious national debate and produced legislation that nobody ever favored and nobody still favors, that the majority of the American people have always been opposed to. And the Founding Fathers chose to keep the taxing power as close as possible to the people. The House of Representatives elected every 2 years by voters in local districts, so that the people can go back and undo things if they don't like what's been done. And unfortunately, by ignoring that procedural rule, we ended up with the horrible hash that is Obamacare.
And what was the government's best argument in response? Good lawyers know their best arguments in response.
The best argument on the other side is that there's a difference between taxes and bills for raising revenue, and that not all taxes have to originate in the House, and that because Obamacare wasn't intended to raise money for the government, but was intended only to get people to buy health insurance, therefore the origination clause doesn't apply because it wasn't really a bill for raising revenue.
And so even though the court has declared it effectively a tax bill, the Supreme Court
That's right.
binds the D.C. Circuit on right. the question of it being a tax bill. The government is arguing that not all tax bills fall under the origination requirement.
That's right. And there are some cases that say that. Now, our response to that is those cases, what they say is that if the government passes basically a penalty, like a monetary penalty for violating a law, or a fee, you have to pay for a license or something like that, the cases say that those are not subject to the origination clause. And that makes perfect sense. But the money you pay if you don't buy insurance under Obamacare goes into the general government treasury to be spent however Congress chooses. So it has to be a bill for
Now, the clerks turn over on the D.C. Circuit, I believe, on July 1. So are you hoping for a decision from the this panel before July 1?
I would not be surprised. I don't think that there's any reason for it to take a very long time at all.
And then you'll go for en banc, and that will take how long for them to turn you down?
Oh, gosh. It could be just weeks.
How long? What's the rule for granting the total circuit review?
I have law clerks to do that for me.
You don't know what that rule is.
No, I get those junior lawyers to do that for me.
And so you hope to argue this before the Supreme Court in the next sitting?
Ideally.
2015.
It's got to be done soon before the system becomes one that nobody can figure out how to undo.
Okay. And so you're really quite the optimist. Back to the Constitution. is there anything else that would give you a glimmer of hope that the Slaughterhouse cases would be reversed? Is there any line of cases at which it's nibbling? Sanchez came back, and it's a very limited decision on whether or not welfare benefits could be two-tiered.
Right.
And it poked its head up there. And I always say nothing is dead forever. But is there anything out there that really gives you hope that substantive due process is making a comeback?
Well, remember, Slaughterhouse is not substantive due process. Slaughterhouse is the Privileges or Immunities Clause.
I'm
hopeful about that on the grounds that there is no reputable legal scholar who thinks Slaughterhouse is right.
But is there a case?
There are my cases.
Yeah, but is there a holding? Is there a holding that has said the Slaughterhouse
case?
There's
no holding.
No.
Okay. No, this is all in dicta, and it's in minority opinions at the moment, and that's because we change the realm of ideas slowly.
I want to play something for you, Tim Sandifer. Gina McCarthy is the administrator of EPA, and she was on with Bill Maher over the weekend, and here's what she said, cut number 12.
Last week announced, I think it was called the Clean Power Program. Some people called it a war on coal. I hope it is a war on coal, is it?
Actually, EPA is all about fighting against pollution and fighting for public health. That's exactly what this is.
Oh, great.
Exactly.
So, Tim Sandifer, how do you react to Gina McCarthy saying, yes, that's exactly what we're about, a war on coal?
Well, I think this really leads into a fundamental issue that your listeners need to understand about how a modern American government works. People have this notion, the schoolhouse rock notion of how a bill becomes a law, and they think that laws get passed that address certain subjects and so forth. And none of that is true. What actually happens in today's world is that a politician runs for office saying he's opposed to bad things. And, of course, you vote for him because you're opposed to bad things too. Who's in favor of bad things? And when he's elected, he passes the No Bad Things Act of 2014, and it's two sentences long. Sentence one says, there shall be no bad things. And sentence two says, there shall be a No Bad Things agency that shall have the power to determine what bad things are, investigate possible bad things, and prosecute those bad things. And then he goes home and he says, look, I stopped bad things. And everybody applauds him, and he feels good about himself. And then the administrators get to work.
Gina McCarthy.
And people like Gina McCarthy and the bureaucrats who are not elected, they are hired, they're protected as civil service workers, so you generally can't even fire them, and those are the people who write the vast majority of the laws under which you live your daily life. People think that, I often get this argument, especially from conservatives, well, if you don't like the way the law is, you shouldn't sue, you should just vote the bums out of office, when in fact those bums not only didn't write most of the laws that take your freedom away, but they often don't have any power over the bums who did take your freedom away.
Speaking of which, I want to play for you Sloan Gibson, who is the interim secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, on the people who ought to be fired, cut number 11.
You know, this idea that let's fire everybody, let's pull everybody's bonus away, that's a bunch of crap. Have we got problems? Yes, we do. And my commitment is that we're going to deal with those problems. But I'm not going to see people sit there and say that we got 350,000 people that aren't worth a crap.
Now, of course, no one has said that. That's a straw man. But it also means we're not going to fire anyone at the VA.
And we are
going to wage war on coal, and we're not going to fire anyone on the VA. And we have an unaccountable government that would not know the Declaration of Independence commitment to liberty than they would know how to recite it, Tim Sandifer, which is why you're a hopeless optimist.
The difference in this world is between the market way and the political way. In the market world, decisions are made by people who bargain among themselves for what they would prefer, and sellers and buyers get together and they agree to exchanges, and that's how decisions get made about how resources are used. In the political world, that isn't what happens. Instead, resources are used based on what politicians think ought to be the way. And so if everybody actually wants coal power, that doesn't matter. What matters is what the administrator wants to allow. And the decisions there get made based on politics, not based on mutual bargaining. And the political realm is a very dangerous one, especially for unpopular folks like myself. I mean, I was a nerd in school. I was very unpopular. There's no way I'm winning a political contest. And we all know what the world of politics is like because we all went to junior high school. And that's the way politics decides things. Who's popular today as opposed to tomorrow and so forth.
Politics is sports for uncoordinated people.
And
Washington is
right.
Hollywood for ugly people.
And,
yes.
And so in the political realm, decisions are not based on what people actually want. It's based on what politicians say they want, which is a hugely different thing. And so a free society is one that keeps as many decisions as possible within the market realm and out of the political realm.
And let's talk to Pat very quickly. You're on with Tim Sander for Pat. Go ahead.
Hey, Hugh, I'm not taking issue with what you said. I'm taking issue on how we treat it. You mentioned that we need to look at Obamacare as Obama's only achievement. It was a mugging, Hugh. We had no choice. We had no preview. Everybody's plans are getting trashed.
Well, it was a mugging, but it was a very successful mugging, and I don't believe the courts are going to use the origination clause. Tim Sandifer, the last 30 seconds to you as to why you should be hopeful that they will.
Because I think that, again, we're talking about a piece of legislation that has never been popular with the voters, is not popular, and again, all we're making is a procedural argument. If the Obamacare is such a good idea, why don't they just go back and pass it the right way?
And of course, and of course, never going to happen. Tim Sandifer, congratulations on the conscience of the Constitution. America, it's in bookstores everywhere. It's linked at HughHewitt.com, and I have tweeted it out. Go and get it. Go and get it today. Give it to all your friends, especially those who don't believe in liberty. They need to come.